Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I serve as the pastor of Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois. We're back with another excellent episode. We're going to get into the New Testament today and rev the engines a little bit and introduce you to some new subjects, I'm sure, that many of our listeners have not yet heard. But to get started, I want to introduce to you our panelists. We have Marcus Minninger, who serves as Associate Professor in New Testament Studies at Mid-America Reformed Seminary. Welcome back, Marcus. It wasn't too long ago that we were speaking with you about an article you wrote, but welcome back now as a panelist.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here. Glad to get into some interesting stuff here today. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. We're going to make a habit of this, Marcus. It took so long for us to get you on the program, but now you're two times in a couple months. I don't know what we're going to do. It's good. It's
well,
good.
Listeners beware.
Listeners beware, indeed. Well, today we're going to be speaking with Peter Gurry, who is a PhD candidate, at least finished all his work. So hopefully very soon we'll be entirely completed and graduated at Fitzwilliam College, the University of Cambridge. Welcome to the program, Peter. It's great to meet you, and it's great to speak with you today.
Good. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We are going to be speaking today about an article from the Journal for the Evangelical Theological Society. This is in volume 59, number 4, titled How Your Greek New Testament is Changing, A Simple Introduction to the Coherence-Based Genealogical Method by our guest today, Peter Gurry. We're going to be speaking about textual criticism, the genealogical method, perhaps some other methods, and speaking about how this new method is being used and how it can be effective, perhaps even what some of the challenges are, not only to its reception, but maybe some weaknesses within the method itself. Who knows? We're going to speak about this and introduce it to you today. But before we get into that, I have just a few things to mention. First is that Reformed Forum is planning to be at the Gospel Coalition Conference April 3rd through 5th in Indianapolis, Indiana. So if you are planning to attend, or if you have yet to decide whether or not you're going to be there, we plan to have a booth and we'll be presenting, and we're looking forward to meeting a lot of people. They've told us that about 7,000 people will be there, so that's quite the crowd. But if you want to be one of those, we'll be there and would love to meet you face-to-face and discuss about Reformed theology and talk about all sorts of fun things. Of course, we also want you to visit our website, reformedforum.org, and there you'll find information about all of our programs, as well as future events and other things that we have in store. And while you're there, you can read a whole series of articles and even blog posts. We have a bunch of written material from one of Reverend Minninger's former students, Dan Ragusa. So if you'd like to read some good biblical, theological, Vossian treatments of matters there, you can find all that available online at reformedforum.org. And while you're there, we encourage you to visit our donate page. If you have benefited from what we're doing and would like to see more, please consider supporting us. You can do so at reformedforum.org/donate. We want to thank everybody for their support of everything we do at Reformed Forum. And this particular program, Christ the Center. Well, with all that being said, brothers, it's great to have you both here on the program today. And Peter, especially, we're excited to talk about this new method, the coherence-based genealogical method. Before we even get into what that is, because it can be a rather complex subject, and we know that there are some inherent limitations to speaking about it just in audio form. We don't have any visual charts or graphs or just even the text before us, which of course aid the understanding. That's why you need the journal article to get a little better grasp. But we hope to provide some basic ideas here today. But as we get started, Peter, could you just describe some of the background to this and just what is textual criticism in general? Why is it important just to lay a foundation here for us discussing this new method?
Sure. Great question, Camden. So textual criticism is a discipline of study that tries to restore the original text for any work where the original copy doesn't survive. And most people think that textual criticism is only needed for ancient documents, so things like the histories of Thucydides or Cicero's works or the New Testament or the Old Testament. But actually, textual criticism is needed on any text where there's question about the original, and that can go all the way up into the modern period with modern authors where there's complications in the original edition, say, of a novel. So textual criticism really covers a wide range of literary works, And for the New Testament, it's needed because the original documents for our 27 books of the New Testament don't survive in manuscript form. So what we're left to do is look at the evidence that we do have among thousands of handwritten manuscripts and citations from the church fathers and ancient translations into languages like Syriac and Coptic and Latin, and try to reconstruct that original text from the evidence that we do have.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the prominent or traditional methods that have been used to do this textual criticism? Clearly, this has been a practice that scholars have engaged in for centuries. How have they done it to this point?
That's a good question. So you can find textual criticism as far back as Origen and Jerome who are doing it. Typically, in the church fathers, we don't find a kind of sustained method. What we tend to find is they work much more with the immediate context, and where a particular variation affects interpretation, they might discuss it and they might mention the oldest manuscripts, but they don't sort of show a concerted, consistent approach to deciding between different readings in the manuscripts. So the modern study of textual criticism, at least for the New Testament, really is developed in the last 200-300 years. And today, there are three generally common methods. The first is what's sometimes called Byzantine priority, and that's a method that thinks that the original text is best found in the agreement between the Byzantine manuscripts, which we'll probably discuss a bit. But the Byzantine manuscripts are most numerous manuscripts of the New Testament, but they're also our latest manuscripts. So that's one method. One method says, look for the agreement among the most manuscripts, and the original is most likely to survive there. A second method is what's sometimes called thoroughgoing eclecticism. And this is a method that essentially says we can't know enough about the manuscripts, when their text is really from or how they relate to each other. So really, anytime there's a variation among them, we simply have to look on what's called internal evidence. That is the author's style or maybe the tendencies of the scribe of that particular manuscript and try to decide on that basis. And then a third method, which is by far the most prominently used method, and the one that most seminary students and pastors will get taught in school, is called reasoned eclecticism. And reasoned eclecticism is something of a middle between those two previous methods. And that is, it tries to look both at the age of manuscripts and their quality and their relationship to each other, and then also what we call internal evidence, like the author's style and the tendencies of scribes and those kinds of questions. So it tries to take into account both types of evidence, what text critics call internal and external evidence. Mm-hmm.
Who are some big historical figures in terms of textual criticism, in centuries past? You mentioned even Origen so early, but I mean, more recently, who's pioneered the field?
Well, probably two of the most famous text critics of the last 150 years are Westcott and Hort, which were two Cambridge scholars who, at the end of the 19th century, produced a Greek New Testament that became the basis for the first official revision of the King James Bible. And it was known as the Revised Version, at least in the UK. And their text really set the stage for modern textual criticism in that many people followed both their method that they laid out in their introduction, but then also the text that they produced is very similar, not exact, but it's very close to the text that we still find today in our editions that you would say get in a New Testament class in seminary. So they're probably the two most prominent figures. Other prominent figures today would be New Testament scholars like Eldon Epp and J.K. Elliott, who teaches in the UK, or he's now retired. David Parker, who also teaches in the UK. Bart Ehrman is probably a name that many of listeners will be familiar with. Dan Wallace. These are some of the names today that people might be aware of.
Yeah, we did an interview with Dan Wallace years ago, so I'm sure I can put that in the in the episode description. People can listen to. Marcus, what do you teach? What class would cover the field of textual criticism?
Yeah, well, the structure for the classes here at Mid-America is similar to what it is, I think, at a lot of Reformed seminaries. So there's a introduction to the New Testament is the first class that all of our incoming students would take in New Testament. And we would cover questions about New Testament canonicity and then text criticism and historical backgrounds to the New Testament, general introductory things. So, yeah, there's a portion of that class that they would all be introduced to, and they we generally have, I mean, historically especially, have used the reasoned eclecticism sort of approach. I think that's of course what I learned when many years ago now, and I'm sure you as well, Camden. And
well, I was taught it.
So more recently, trying to help the students come to grips with, okay, well, these are the sort of changes that are underfoot. Here's where the emphases shift and so forth. So it's a timely topic for the article in that respect, I think.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. It's really kind of a frontier. Peter, one thing you speak of quite a bit, or at least you introduced to me in the article, is the common error method. Well, what is that, and how does that relate to what you've already spoken of?
The common error method has been much more, if you'll forgive the pun, common outside biblical studies, and particularly outside the New Testament. It's much more commonly used in classical literature for textual criticism of those works. But the common error method is based on a very simple principle, and that principle is that where manuscripts agree with each other in an error, we can assume that their shared error implies a common ancestor. Now, the key in that principle is the definition of an error. An error essentially means a scribal innovation, a scribal change that's clearly not original to the author. And so it works sort of like if you think of a family tree, that if you have two people and they have shared traits, you can assume that their shared traits go back to a shared ancestor. And that's the basic principle that it works from. It tries to find these shared errors and then retrace the family tree as far back as it can get. And then once it gets as far back as it can get, it tries to resolve any differences from there. But doing that, producing that family tree using common errors, allows you to eliminate a lot of the textual variation that otherwise might give you trouble.
What are some shortfalls with that method? I mean, it certainly can't work in every scenario, can it?
That's right. No, there's a couple of shortfalls. The first is, the most significant one, and particularly with relation to the New Testament, is the method pretty much breaks down when you have what's called contamination. That is when one branch of the family tree has mixed with another branch of the family tree, it kind of throws the method for a loop. And what you can end up getting is manuscripts that are really descendants of other manuscripts end up looking like their ancestors when that's not true. So it ends up reversing some of the relationships that are actually true. So contamination is one of the major problem, and that's the reason why it hasn't been used on the New Testament. A second criticism of the method is that it risks being circular, in that if the goal of textual criticism is to identify the author's text, the author's reading at places where there's variation, then identifying common errors, you already have to ask the question, well, is this an error or not? And identifying those errors can be a bit tricky. So it's been criticized on those grounds. I don't think that criticism holds a lot of weight when the method is used carefully, but it is a concern, and it does mean the method is perhaps not as objective as some who've tried to use it have made it out to be. But it is a very, very good method otherwise, and it has been widely used, especially in classical literature.
It seems like one of the presuppositions of that method, well, first, it can only deal with certain types of errors, right? Like if there are errors that could have happened commonly or independently, it's not going to be able to account for the fact that two witnesses or two scribes just happen to make the same mistake. But also, one of the presuppositions is that scribes only using one source, correct?
That's right. That's also another presupposition, and that's another problem. That's using more than one source is essentially a form of contamination.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then, now that I think perhaps leads us to the point where I can just ask the very basic question I'm sure many of the listeners want to hear. Then, what is the coherence-based genealogical method? Just in general terms, how does that fit into some of this tradition and history?
Yeah, great. So the coherence-based genealogical method, and I'll start by apologizing for the cumbersome name, which I did not pick. it was foisted upon me by others, and I was stuck using it. So, but the coherence-based genealogical method, it shares basically the same a common goal with other genealogical methods, and that is it's an attempt to relate texts to each other and to use those relationships to resolve textual problems. So in that, it's very similar to the common error method. It has the same basic goals. Where it differs is the fundamental principle on which it operates. So the common error method, as I said, works by looking for these shared errors, and the principle is shared error implies shared origin, or common error implies common ancestry. Whereas the coherence method instead says, rather than looking for these shared errors, why not just try to relate the variants themselves to each other and then aggregate them all together, or add them all up, and then try to establish the manuscript relationships based on the relationship of their individual variants. So the basic principle is, if you can relate the variants between manuscripts to each other, then the totality of those variant relationships will give you an overall relationship of the manuscripts themselves.
I don't know if all of our listeners are familiar with the term variant, but that's similar to what was being said before as error. Those would be the same thing in this usage of them, at least in a sense that a variant would just be any place where two manuscripts differ from one another. They vary from each other. One of those could be accurate or the other. You have to decide which, but obviously they can't both be accurate in that specific place. So the coherence-based method is trying to solve a whole bunch of individual errors or variants, which is original, which reading and which manuscript is original, and then which were produced as a result subsequently later on. And if you do that on one variant after another and enter all the information into a computer that's able to begin analyzing this massive data, then you can come up with a large model, which I'm sure Peter would be able to describe better than I can.
Yeah,
that's a very good, Marcus has described it well.
Yeah. Who developed this method originally, or who is a pioneer of it?
Good question. It was developed by a man named Gerd Mink, who works at the Institute for New Testament Textual Research in a town called Münster, Germany, which is in
small town.
Northwest Germany. Yeah.
Right.
I suppose. Not that small.
No, that's good. That's good. With this method, you know, having mentioned that, and Marcus even mentioned the usage of computers. Now, you know, everything a computer does is algorithmic to a degree, so it's conceivable that we could do these types of things if we had enough time. But practically speaking, would this method even have been conceivable or possible 50 years ago?
No, it really wouldn't have. Now, the principles, yes, and it's conceivable that somebody could have sat down on paper and done all the math, because the most complicated the math gets in this method is addition and division. Mm-hmm. So you could do that on your own if you wanted.
Yeah, I could do that. But I could do that.
You could do that. But in terms of speed and the amount of data it accounts for,
yeah,
it's really hard to imagine the method without the computer.
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense. Now, we mentioned variants. We mentioned some other terms here. But another important distinction, at least that I gathered from the article within CBGM, is that a witness differs from a text. How would you
That's
define
right.
those two, and how are they different?
That's a very good question. So a moment ago, I spoke about manuscript relationships, and that was really somewhat imprecise because the manuscript refers to the physical artifact, the papyrus or the parchment and the ink and the text that's on it. It refers to the whole thing, any artwork that may be a part of it, the size, the structure and layout of the manuscript. Those are all part of the physical artifact, the document. But the CBGM is actually interested in the text itself. And so it makes a distinction between the manuscript as a physical artifact and the text as what we might define as simply the series of words in that particular manuscript.
Yeah.
So it's easy to think of the distinction if you think the manuscript is a physical object that could sit on your desk, whereas the text is something I could type into a computer and you could then take with you anywhere you wanted.
Sure.
The text hasn't changed. Now, you've changed the format of it, but the sequence of words hasn't changed. And the reason the distinction is important in this method is because a manuscript may be much younger than its text.
Mm-hmm.
So if for example, you imagine a 4th century manuscript that gets copied in the 15th century, every word that gets copied accurately in the 15th century is still a 4th century text.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really important distinction because you may have a very young manuscript that nevertheless preserves a very old text.
Yeah, that you can have multiple manuscripts that have the same witness if they're identical copies too. So that itself is kind of common sense when you hear it, but perhaps those principles haven't been part of a study method before. So this seems a critical method here that allows us to account for those things.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's a principle you have to be careful with, because all things being equal, if you have two manuscripts and you don't know anything else about them, you would prefer the manuscript that's older because you assume it's closer to the original. But this distinction reminds us that that assumption is not always a safe assumption. And so one thing the method helps us to do is evaluate and test that assumption. And one of the exciting developments from the method is that we can identify some texts in manuscripts that are themselves not very old, but nevertheless preserve a text that overall is much older than the manuscripts themselves. And that's always very exciting.
When you say the text preserves a reading that's very old, just so everybody understands, we're saying that it's possible that that text preserves a much more accurate or reading. In other words, a reading that's closer to the original. So it, like Peter said, generally older manuscripts are going to be more accurate, closer to the original, because they're closer in time to the original. But it could certainly be that a more recently produced manuscript is in fact, at least at any given point in it, reflecting something much closer to the original. In that sense, older is better because it's closer to when John or Paul or Peter or whomever it was wrote the New Testament itself.
Hmm. So this is a relatively new method, but is it being used now? Has it been received? Where are we finding it in action?
That's a good question. Yes, it is being used. And one of the main reasons for my interest in the method is that it's being used on the two most popular editions of the Greek New Testament that scholars, pastors, and translators use on a regular basis. The first is called the Nestle-Aland Novum Testamentum, which seminarians may be familiar as sort of the blue edition. And then the one that's slightly more popular, I'm told, is the United Bible Society's Greek New Testament, which is generally red and is a bit more accessible. Those two editions have shared the same text for the last 30 or 40 years. They've kind of worked in tandem with each other, and they have some other differences. But as far as their text, the text itself, the main text of the editions, those have agreed for quite some time now. And they haven't been revised in several decades. And so they're just now being revised. And the latest editions are the 5th edition of the UBS and the 28th edition of the Nestle-Aland. And both of these editions in the Catholic epistles are using this coherence method. And at the moment, it's also being used on the text of Acts, and soon it should be used on John and then Revelation. And then the plan is to apply it to the entire Greek New Testament. So when everything's said and done, the dust finally settles, this new coherence-based genealogical method will have been applied to the entire text of the New Testament.
Oh, wow. So people who already have the NA28, I'm one of those and have had it for a while, we've already been using or been the recipients of the product of this coherence-based genealogical method.
That's right, yep. So what I wanted to do with my own research at Cambridge was to try to get a handle on how is this new method changing our New Testament. So that's the title of the essay that we're talking about today, is how your Greek New Testament is changing.
Mm-hmm. So how then is it changing? What are some of the preliminary results?
Yeah. Yep. Great question. So I try to identify three main changes that it's introduced. The first is the most obvious, and that is it's introduced textual changes. So the text of the Nestle 28th edition has 34 differences in the Catholic epistles with the 27th.
Many.
Okay. And that's the same with the UBS edition, same number of changes. Most of these are minor. They wouldn't affect a sermon. They probably wouldn't even be mentioned, a lot of them, in a commentary. You'd struggle a lot of them to translate into English. But there are a few that are pretty significant, like in Jude 5, for example, the text now reads that Jesus is the one who saved a people from Egypt, where the previous edition said it was the Lord, which obviously you could take as a reference to God the Father. So that's a significant change. And then another one is in 2 Peter 3:10, we're told that the earth and all that is in it will be found or will be exposed or something like this. It's a bit difficult to know how to translate the verb there. And the new Nestle 28th edition now says the earth and all that is in it will not be found. So they've added the word not in there where it wasn't before.
That's
so
different.
That's different. That's yep. You're right. That's very different. So 34 textual changes, a few of them are significant and significant potentially for theology as well. Then there's slightly more uncertainty on the part of the editors in the Catholic epistles from using this method. So before, your 27th edition used to use brackets to surround words that the editors were not completely convinced about. So they generally favored the words in brackets. They thought they were original, but they weren't completely convinced, so they put them into brackets. They've now abandoned the use of the brackets with this new method, and instead they use a little diamond shape. And the diamond is the diamond marks places where the editors formally refrain from any rating about which variant is original. So it means they're complete. The scales are evenly balanced as far as they're concerned, and they refuse to give you any indication as to which one they think is original.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So so there's a bit more uncertainty in terms of the type of uncertainty that they're marking in the new edition. And there's also there are more places that they mark as uncertain. So I forget the numbers. I think there were 30 some places of brackets in the Catholic epistles, and there's about 40 diamonds in the Nestle 28th edition. So as I say, there's slightly more uncertainty on the part of the editors about the original text.
Well, speaking about some uncertainty with the text itself, there on those smaller points. Is there uncertainty with this method, with the CBGM? Has it been received by the scholarly community, or is there general kind of uncertainty or hesitation with it?
I would say there's a general, I don't want to say discomfort, but I think there's a sense in which people do not understand it yet, and people are understandably nervous when people are making changes to their New Testament.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think those two things combined have led to what I think is a bit unfortunate reaction from a lot of scholars, which is a kind of knee-jerk distrust of the method.
I'm wondering if it might have to do with some of just the nature of the method. If computers are involved, and you know, it might seem to some as some kind of magic black box, and so stuff goes in and stuff comes out. But if they don't understand everything about how it works, there could be just some unease because of the lack of knowledge. Is some of that in play?
No, I think that's actually the majority of it, in fact, Camden. So yeah, you've hit the nail on the head with that. One of my main burdens in the article was to try to help address that.
Yeah.
Because it, you know, I always tell people, I say, I have lots and lots of sympathy for people who don't understand it. Because it took me a year of my PhD just to get my head around how it works, let alone how to say anything valuable about it, you know? So if it took me a year, now I may not be the sharpest tool in the shed, so you got to take account of that. But if it took me a year to get my head around it, and that was pretty much all I was trying to do was figure it out, you know, I have a lot of sympathy with people, you know, a New Testament scholar who's teaching New Testament introduction and text criticism is not his expertise. You know, text criticism is already a technical discipline, and then you add this to the mix, and it can feel pretty intimidating. So I just want to say, yeah, I have a lot of sympathy, and one of the things I hope to do in future work is to help address that and make the method a bit more accessible to people so that they can really understand it.
It's one thing to make the method itself accessible, which I think is an admirable endeavor. It's an important thing that we do that, but there's also the difficulty of disclosing one's findings. Like, I guess, at least with the text, the UBS 5 or the NA 28, at the end of the day, there, you even say in the article that a human is deciding whether or not to go with this variant or with this form. So at the end of the day, there's a human arbiter who's putting this in the critical apparatus or not. But even there, still, isn't it a great challenge to document how one came to these conclusions? I mean, with a method that's as complicated as CBGM, even if it's, you know, a stellar method, it's still hard to even tell you.
I think that is one of the challenges of the new method is explaining the rationale in using it, because it sometimes I like to explain it as a tool, And the hard thing can be to figure out how did the editors of your Nestle text use the tool in any particular place. So in the article, one of the things I did was I put an appendix in and tried to list all the places where the editors have discussed their use of the method in particular points of variation. And at one point, they had promised us a commentary, a textual commentary on their decisions. And I'm hopeful that they will do that for Acts. I'm told that they are keeping notes for their work in Acts. I think when they did the Catholic epistles, they frankly got overwhelmed with the amount of work. And they just had to get the edition itself out. And I think they just ran out of time to go back and do the commentary. So unfortunately, it's unfortunate that they weren't able to, because I think that would help a lot in demystifying their own decisions. But you're absolutely right. That is a concern and an issue.
It seems like for the scholarly community, of course, it wouldn't be for someone like me, who's just a lowly systematician, but for somebody who's actually dealing with this, and I mean, not just, you know, doing exegesis, which is the ultimate goal here, that we would, you know, study and learn more through scripture, but the textual scholar, the person who's dealing with these things day to day, and the people, the editors of even the NA28 and UBS5, it almost seems like you'd have some sort of like way to share your data. You might have to like be passing thumb drives around or letting people download your inputs so that they can check them with your algorithms and whatnot. That we've gone much further than just being able to communicate our findings, you know, in text. We have to communicate it in some sort of digital form, because that's what's being used to create the findings. I mean, the method is computational.
Yeah. I think the introduction of computers, whether we realize it or not, raises the level of expectation about transparency. Because people are so used to sharing information freely over the internet or even just a thumb drive, I think we expect even greater transparency than we did before. In some cases, I think that's a bit unwarranted, in that actually what we have available online, for example, they put all the results online. So folks will see, I think I've given the URL in the article of where they can go to actually see the data behind
this new method. So they're already doing that. Okay.
They're already doing that. Yeah. Now there's more you could see, obviously. You could, if you wanted, you could see the actual databases behind it, which I have seen. And I can tell you there's just a lot of data.
Yeah,
so it's
sure.
not anything spectacular.
Sure.
But actually what's new is that because they put these things online, at any place of variation in your Nestle edition, at least in the Catholic epistles, you can now see how the editors themselves relate every single variation at that point. And that's something we've never had access to before. I mean, the best we had was, some listeners will probably be familiar with Bruce Metzger's textual commentary, which accompanied the UBS fourth edition. And there he tried to explain all the variants that were in the UBS edition. But as some readers or listeners will know, the UBS is pretty selective in the number of variants that it lists. Whereas now we have, you can access for 3,000 places of variation in the Catholic epistles, you can see in every single one how the editors related every single variant they had to deal with. And that's an overwhelming amount of data. And it's out there on the internet. People can go check it out right now if they wanted to. So in some ways, they're far more transparent than they've ever been. But I do agree with you that the lack of a textual commentary has been a problem.
Marcus, when they get to Romans, can I expect a new appendix in your dissertation?
boy, I hope it should be published and gone by then. People will already have forgotten about it. No need. I think it's important juncture, though, as far as considering this topic, because to put the information out there, like you're describing, this data that can be accessed online, that's certainly admirable, but on the other hand, to go through it in this tremendous depth that would be required just to understand what was done, and then to consider, well, what if we tweaked a few of the early decisions that had been made that go into this particular model being used? You're dealing with such an enormous enterprise that I think it's hard to come to grips with, like you said, Peter. I mean, even for someone who's developing an expertise in it through a PhD program, much less, you know, anybody else. I guess here's one of my basic questions. Make sure that we have this out there for the listeners. What you're basically do what the practitioners of this would be doing is making all of these individual textual decisions about the variant in the first variant in 2 Peter 3:10, and then the second variant in 2 Peter 3:10, and then the third one, and the fourth one, and the fifth one. Or sorry, no, those are the same. Anyway, so all four of those. And then go into 2 Peter 3:11, et cetera, make all of those individual decisions regarding, we'll just say, the most, what are judged to be the most crucial manuscripts, how at each individual variant, how the manuscripts related to each other on that variant, and then next, how all the manuscripts relate to each other on the next variant, and then next, the one after that, et cetera. Every one of those very, very early decisions about individual manuscripts has a degree of doubt in it. In other words, and that's just the nature of text criticism.
That's right.
It's more or less probable in any given instance that those individual small-scale decisions were made correctly in any individual case. So maybe it's a 90% probability in one instance, and maybe it's a 70% probability in another instance, whatever it might be.
Yep.
But then when you're building this enormous model on the back of all of these small decisions, each of which has some doubt involved, to go back through as an outsider and now analyze the model and perhaps question some of the early small scale decisions and have any idea, okay, what impact would that have on the total outcome, the model itself, or would it not have any outcome? That's a tremendous endeavor. I guess this is one of the areas where it's a little bit daunting for a professor or anybody else who's not really ensconced in it. Do you see that issue of many small decisions, each of which only have some percentage of certainty leading to the overall model? Does that make the overall model in some sense precarious? Since we're so new in this discipline, are we out for significant revolutions in redoing these models or competing models, et cetera?
Yeah.
How does that factor of certainty and uncertainty, degrees of certainty, degrees of uncertainty, kind of play into all this, do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question, because as you said, the problem is when you add a lot of more or less uncertain decisions together, you don't necessarily get more certainty. You actually just get more and more uncertainty. So that's a very good question. There's a couple things to say to that question. Yes, it's a good question. It's one I try to consider and address in the dissertation. And the way I tried to address it there is by saying, what if we started from a different method? So rather than the editors who currently use the coherence method, they practice reason eclecticism. So they generally prefer early manuscripts over late manuscripts and some of those things. What if we started from the Byzantine priority position, which assumes that the original reading is in the Byzantine manuscripts? And so that's what I did. I actually changed all the places in the Catholic epistles where the Byzantine reading disagrees with the Nestle text. And surprisingly, there's only a couple hundred of them. And so overall, the results were pretty much what I expected. The Byzantine manuscripts end up being at the top of the family tree as sort of the origin source of the rest, like I expected. So there was a kind of a flipping in the diagrams. But actually, overall, the impact was much, much less than I expected. The implications, say, for particular points of variation were not greatly significant. And part of the reason for that is that the method tries to relate manuscripts from two types of evidence. The first type of evidence is exactly what you said. It's relating individual variants and making textual decisions, and that's subjective. That requires the editor to bring all their text critical judgment to the table. And that, as you said, can have more or less certainty. But there's a second piece of relating manuscripts, and that's what the method calls pre-genealogical coherence. And it's much simpler than the name implies. It basically just means the level of agreement between any two manuscripts. So if you take Codex Sinaiticus and Codex Vaticanus, two of our earliest witnesses for the Catholic epistles, and compare them at all the places where they can be compared, pre-genealogical coherence just tells you how often they agree out of how many places they can be compared. And the average agreement for all manuscripts in the Catholic epistles that they used for the edition was something like 87%. And so there's a vast degree of agreement between manuscripts. And the important thing about that is, what that means is that that element of manuscript agreement is pretty objective. Now, it's not completely objective, but it's much more objective than the editor's own decisions where manuscripts disagree. So the method itself is a unique combination of both of those factors. And what my own research found was that the more objective type of data had the larger influence and impact in the results that you get from the method. So I don't want to suggest that making different decisions won't have any impact. It certainly will. But the fact is, our Greek New Testament manuscripts agree so much with each other at such a high rate that no matter, I don't want to say no matter what, but even if I take sort of the other end of the text critical spectrum, if you will, and prefer the Byzantine reading at every point of variation, the results I got were not significantly different.
Would that be partly because when you're entering in, if I'm not mistaken, you're saying they're entering in the data about every variant or close to it?
Yeah.
You said 3,000 or something in the general
epistles? Yeah, that's
so right. So because such a large percentage of those variants would be fairly obvious.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, anybody could question, is it really obvious? But when you study texts and text criticism, you say such a large percentage of these are really not debated by scholars how to resolve what's going on. That provides a buffer which within the model that a very large amount of the input about even just the variants includes variants that are readily solvable without much controversy. And so that gives a large amount of non-debated or not very debated input alongside of a small percentage of debated input. Would that be?
That's right. I think that's an important element of it, of exactly what I was saying. So I want to say the first time they went through out of 3,000 places, they made upwards of 80% of the decisions without too much trouble. And the idea of the method is use places where decisions are easy to help you decide places where they're more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to me, you can always question those easier decisions. Are they really easy? And ultimately, I hope the method will be opened up to the public so other people can do that and test it more. But I don't think there will be a lot of disagreement on that. The vast majority of variants, as you explained. Yeah.
Now, Peter, this might be not a good analogy, but I'm going to pose an analogy, and you can help position the method to the analogy, because I think many of our listeners, and then correct me or whatever, it might be good for like a concrete example. Some people who have taken statistics or at least know some basic statistics will be familiar with a regression analysis, where you have a whole bunch of points on a XY axis, and then you can use an iterative statistical method to attempt to minimize the distance between all the points. So very few of the points will actually be on the regression line, but what the method is doing, it'll iterate throughout and find the best fit, quote unquote, which minimizes the overall discrepancies or distances of any point from the line. And then when that method will produce not only the right slope and intercept for you to draw the line, but also give you a certain like R squared value or whatever. It could give you loosely a probability of how good of a fit this is. I mean, with an iterative algorithmic method within the computer, like theoretically the method could test every single genealogical possibility and could then alongside of certain probabilities or at least confidence that human editors have in some of the variants could find what is, I guess, analogously the best fit or the most probable fit, correct? Is that, I mean, how far off am I from understanding this?
I think I'd only want to adjust that metaphor in terms of, I'd want to add in quite a bit more of the human element.
Okay. Okay.
But yeah, it's definitely, in terms of coherence, one of the things that the word coherence in the title partly means finding decisions and making decisions that cohere or agree or fit with all the other data that so far you've collected through the computer. So part of that data is your own decisions, the own textual decisions you've made at points of variation, and part of it is what I call pre-genealogical coherence, which is the just base level of agreement between manuscripts.
So
there's definitely that element of trying to find what fits the data that's so far you've collected, and some of that data you've collected is data that you've in fact produced yourself from your own decisions. So yeah, that's not a bad analogy for the mathematically inclined, I should say.
Okay.
For the non-mathematically inclined, that may be worse than the,
well, I mean, most people could see, you know, just generally, if you have a scattering of lines, you could, you know, if they're somewhat grouped, you get the idea of, well, if I draw a line this way, it seems to be the best fit for these. Of course, with this, we're talking about multiple parents or, you know, multiple ancestors, and it's a network type of thing. But you can imagine, I suppose, iterating throughout the network an infinite number of times and figuring out what family tree is. Like, if you just threw 100 people in a room and you say they're all related somehow, you know, figure it out. You know, you could say, well, if Bill was the ultimate father, then that would mean X, Y, and Z. You could just keep trying every combination and see, well, this seems to be the best fit.
And that's not bad, because one of the things the method is trying to do is try to find the simplest explanation for all the data that's collected.
I see.
So, and I don't know, I can't remember if I say this in the paper, but one of the things I mentioned in the dissertation is that that's actually a potential concern for the method. And the reason is that the method has some what I think are good built-in assumptions about how scribes copy manuscripts that helps you use the method in a way when you have to make a decision. So you've got three witnesses, three manuscripts, and two of them could potentially be an ancestor for one, and you want to narrow it down to the most important ancestor. It has some principles for helping you make that decision. But the problem is that those assumptions are all based on simplicity.
It's like an Occam's razor. That might not actually be the case. Yeah,
exactly. Occam's razor. And the reality is, when you're dealing with history, history doesn't always follow Occam's razor.
Yeah.
So we just have to remember, I don't think there's any way around this, because when we're dealing with history, we're always dealing with a selection of the evidence from what actually once existed. So we're always dealing with partial evidence. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's important for us to remember that our hypotheses at the end, using this method, they are the simplest hypotheses, and that may not mean they're the most historically accurate hypotheses.
Yeah, that's an extreme.
It's another way of saying they're the best we can do now. If we come up with a different method that might do better, if we find more manuscripts or we make better decisions, you know, the hypothesis will need to be revised in light of that.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Good to know.
Peter,
what are the future? What do you see as the near future for studies in this field? What are you hoping for? What are the new frontiers for academic research? What are you working on? And what would you like other people to get involved with?
That's good questions. As far as text criticism concerns, it's a pretty exciting time actually to be part of it. You know, text criticism has a kind of dry and dusty reputation, and some of that is deserved. But I'd say two things in particular are exciting right now. And one is the discovery of new manuscripts and more in-depth study of old manuscripts. So text criticism is an exciting discipline because we're always finding new evidence. If you work on Romans, we've had Romans for a long time. You can look at Greco-Roman sources afresh, but chances are you probably don't have new Greco-Roman sources that have been discovered in the last 10 years. With text criticism, you do. You have lots of manuscripts that have been discovered and lots of manuscripts that need to be studied and haven't been. So I'd say on the side of manuscripts, there's lots of room for future study there. And then I think the use of computers is really going to continue to transform the discipline. And I'm particularly excited about how computer tools for relating manuscripts can be used in the future to try to help us better understand how the text developed over time, and using that understanding to then revisit places where we're still not quite sure, not quite convinced what the original text is.
I agree with you on that point. But do you think then that budding New Testament scholars or hopeful future New Testament or Old Testament scholars would do well to study some computer science or have some fluency, at least in some computer languages?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say, it depends on the person and sort of their bent.
Yeah.
But if you're a person who already has a background in computers or you have an interest in computers and you have a developing or budding interest in biblical studies, there is a lot
of
room to weld those two together. Yep.
So what are you working on then?
So the dissertation, I'm in the process of just lightly revising it and hoping to submit it for publication soon. And then I'm working actually on a simplified introduction to the CBGM, something that will be more than the article was, but less than my dissertation was. So I'm co-authoring that at the moment with another text critic, and we really hope it will be a kind of a student's guide, in the sense that it will be very step by step, showing you how to actually use the tools that are now available to make textual decisions. Uh-huh. So hopefully, the kind of thing that a seminary student or a commentator or a translator could pick up and be able to start using the CBGM in their own work. So they're kind of the two big things I'm working on now. That's a few great. Other irons in the fire as well.
Well, when you get that article done, I'm sure that we can engage in some source criticism and see which parts you wrote and which parts your co-author wrote.
That's right. I'm sure. Yeah.
So
I'll leave that to others.
Yeah. Where can people find you online, Peter, or perhaps even follow up on this topic? Is there a good place to go online?
Yeah, good question. So the article itself I've put online at academia.edu.
Wonderful.
I have linked to the PDF that Jets put up for that. So readers can or listeners can go on there and find that. And then I also contribute to a blog called Evangelical Textual Criticism, which is a blog that's been around for about 10 years. And I'm just one of the contributors there. If you just do a Google search for Evangelical Textual Criticism, it'll be the first thing that comes up. So
we'll definitely include those links in the episode description so that people can follow up and learn more. I've been very interested in this subject. I'm very thankful that you published this article and that you joined us today. It's been a pleasure to speak with you and to meet you, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Great. Thanks so much, Camden and Marcus, both of you, for the engagement.
You're absolutely welcome. I do want to encourage people to not only visit these links we'll have in the episode description at academia.edu and the Evangelical Textual Criticism blog, but you can visit MidAmerica online at midamerica.edu. And we're online at reformedforum.org. You can not only listen to other episodes of our program here, Christ the Center, but there are many other podcasts as well as blog posts and articles and some future publications. So keep your eyes open for that. I do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.